Good morning, everyone. So over the next 45 minutes to 1 hour, we will discuss some points about assessing myocardial viability and about cardiac positron emission tomography. So to start with, we will cover a little bit about what is PET, discuss some PET protocols, talk about advantages, indications, and the radiotracers that we use with positron emission tomography. Then switch gears and talk about assessment of myocardial viability using SPECT as well as PET. So what is PET? Most of you are familiar with SPECT. PET is positron emission tomography. It's an unstable nucleus that collides with an electron and releases two photons, 511 kV. And these photons are released at 180 degrees to each other. And the distance this unstable nucleus travels before it collides with an electron, this is what is called positron range. And if you think about it, the event is actually happening here, but the event is recorded by the scanner at where the annihilation takes place. So therefore, the longer the positron range, the lower the image resolution. And what determines positron range? It's basically the energy of the positron. Higher energy positrons travel a little longer distance compared to lower energy positrons. So radio tracers that have a lower energy positrons tend to have somewhat better image resolution compared to radio tracers that have a higher energy positron. Now the other distinction from SPECT is that you can see that it's tomographic acquisition. And as opposed to SPECT, where you have two detectors going around the patient in 180 degree acquisition, here it's a simultaneous tomographic acquisition. So the patient is inside the scanner, and then you can see all these are PET detectors in a circular fashion. So this is a full ring detector PET, and the positron emission happens here, and the photons are detected at diametrically opposite detectors in all directions at the same time. So this is a true tomographic acquisition. So why is this important? We'll discuss later. This is important because you are able to obtain dynamic images of the radio tracers simultaneously in multiple projections. So you have much higher temporal resolution, and using these dynamic images, you're able to quantify myocardial blood flow. So what about radio tracers that we use with PET? Broadly, they can be classified into perfusion tracers and metabolic tracers. Perfusion tracers are the tracers that we use to study myocardial blood flow. Primarily, they include rubidium, N13 ammonia, O15 labeled water, and a new F18 labeled agent that's currently under development. Rubidium is produced by a generator and is available to sites without cyclotrons. Therefore, it's more commonly used. We'll discuss more details about it in the next slide. What about myocardial metabolism? We have several tracers to study myocardial metabolism. The most commonly used in clinical practice is F18 labeled FDG, fluorodeoxyglucose. That tracer is used to study myocardial glucose metabolism. We can also have several C11 labeled tracers, C11 acetate, C11 palmitate, to study oxidative and fatty acid metabolism. The C11 labeled tracers are primarily used for research purposes at this time. They have a shorter half-life, you need an on-site cyclotron, therefore they're not widely used clinically. So what is an ideal radio tracer to study myocardial blood flow? So as we all know, an ideal tracer is one where the myocardial uptake is linearly related to myocardial blood flow. So you want a tracer that's which is taken up less when the flow is less, and it's taken up a lot more when there's hyperemic flow. So you want to see this linear relationship between myocardial blood flow on the horizontal axis and the tracer uptake in the vertical axis. So the tracer that comes closest to ideal is O15 labeled water, and that's the reason why that's used in most research applications for quantifying myocardial blood flow. Now the next tracer that's shown here is N13 labeled ammonia. As you can see, that uptake is quite linear at the lower flow rates. But once you come up to higher flow rates, there's a little bit of veering off from this diagonal line. And the same is true for the other tracers, thallium rubidium and technetium-based traces. So the key to note on this slide is at low flow rates, when you're talking about less than 2 ml, all these radio tracers are relatively taken up linearly in relation to flow. So if you have a tight coronary stenosis that is limiting your hyperemic blood flow to about 2 ml per gram per minute, any of these tracers can be used successfully to diagnose obstructive atherosclerosis. Now, if you look at this end of the extreme, at the right end, where you're talking about flows between 2 to 4, so at this range, you can see that a tracer that's linearly taken up is better suited for quantifying myocardial blood flow compared to tracers that have this plateau phase, because there's no big difference here. So the take-home point on this slide is most tracers that are available for clinical use are equally good for diagnosing obstructive coronary atherosclerosis. For quantifying myocardial blood flow and for studying preclinical atherosclerosis, a tracer that's higher up in the curve and more linearly related to flow would be superior. So this is a schematic to illustrate the same. Let's compare O15 labeled water to technetium. And you can take a look at a patient whose RCA is normal with 0% disease, where the peak stress flow would be 4 ml. So what would you see in this patient where the LAD has a 50% stenosis? So the uptake in the RCA region would be 4, and that would translate into this radio tracer uptake on your vertical axis. And the blood flow here, the blood flow in the disease segment with the RCA would be about 2. And that would translate to this myocardial uptake. So the contrast between the non-diseased on the top and diseased on the bottom is kind of small. The same lesion, if you image using, let's assume you're imaging with O15 labeled water, the non-diseased area would take up a lot more blood flow, a lot more radio tracer because of the linear uptake. And you can see the 4 here would reflect the uptake in the non-diseased. The diseased segment in the LAD would take up much less than the non-diseased. And as you see here, the contrast between the normal and the abnormal is much wider with this tracer compared to technetium. So this is how it would translate into ability to look at perfusion defects and identify obstructive coronary disease. But as we discussed again, most of the severe disease is in the range of less than 2, so we should be fine for clinical purposes. So properties of radio tracers. Perfusion tracers are shown on top, metabolic tracers are shown in the bottom. You can see O15 labeled water and nitrogen, 13 labeled ammonia are cyclotron-produced tracers. Rubidium is generator-produced. The half-life of oxygen is 2.1 minutes. N13 ammonia is 10 minutes, and rubidium is 76 seconds. And this is important. The reason the half-life is important for practical purposes is if you have a tracer that has a very short half-life, like rubidium, 76 seconds, this makes exercise stress testing with PET somewhat more challenging. Because by the time you inject the patient in the treadmill and bring them to the scanner, a good part of the radio tracer has already decayed. In contrast, if you use a tracer such as ammonia with a 10-minute half-life, you can perform exercise treadmill testing, inject the patient on the treadmill, and you still have time to image the perfusion. So the short half-life, the half-life of any given radio tracer is clinically relevant for choosing the stress protocol. It's also relevant in the sense if for any reason there's a technical difficulty, the radio tracer is infiltrated. If you use a short-acting tracer, you can re-inject and reacquire an image, especially the resting scan, so you don't lose the scan. Whereas if you use a longer half-life tracer and it's infiltrated, you basically have lost the image. You need to wait at least 1 hour or longer for ammonia to re-image. So that's something to keep in mind. Again, positron range, as we discussed, rubidium has slightly longer positron range, therefore the image quality may be less crisp compared to ammonia. Having said that, O15 labeled water has a quite a small positron range, But the image quality with O15 water is not as good as ammonia, and primarily that's because this trace is freely diffusible between the blood pool and the myocytes. So you don't have a stable myocyte uptake. So typically O15 labeled water images are used for blood flow quantitation, but for interpretation of the perfusion images, they're not as good as ammonia. What about metabolic tracers? Carbon-11 is produced by a cyclotron, 20-minute half-life. It's taken up by active extraction, short positron range. The more important tracer for us is F18 labeled FDG. At this time, it has 110-minute half-life. It's a glucose analog, and it is taken up into the myocytes through glucose transporters. It has an excellent positron range, very good quality images. Once again, note the 110-minute half-life. Because of the longer half-life of F18 labeled tracers, these tracers can be produced by a cyclotron, but transported to sites that don't have a cyclotron. So many centers are using FDG for oncology imaging as well as for viability imaging, even though they may not have an on-site cyclotron. Now there's a new perfusion tracer being developed labeled with F18, and that will be the big advantage of the tracer again. So you may be able to get unit dose radio tracers, F18 labeled perfusion tracer, to sites that don't have cyclotrons, making PET more available and more useful in terms of using it in conjunction with exercise. I just wanted to highlight, please remember the half-lives. For some reason, this is always on the boards. Frequently on the boards, not always. It's frequently on the boards. The shortest half-life radio tracer is rubidium, 76 seconds. The longest half-life is F18 FDG, 110 minutes. Then C11 is 20 minutes, oxygen is 2 minutes, and nitrogen is 10 minutes. So if you remember the shortest half-life and the longest half-life, rubidium, 76 seconds, F18, 110, I think it'll make it easy for you. So what are the three steps in imaging patients with PET? The first step is called a localizing scan. The PET detector width is about 15.6 centimeters. So the localizing scan is performed to make sure that the patient's heart fits within the scan detector field of view. This can be, the localizing scan can be done using CT with PET CT scanners or using a low-dose radionuclide injection with dedicated PET scanners. Then you perform a transmission scan. Once again, with a dedicated PET, it's a radionuclide attenuation correction map, transmission map, or with CT, you obtain a CT scan of the chest, non-contrast, low-dose, free-breathing scan. That scan is then converted into an attenuation map using special filters. So the emission images are subsequently obtained and corrected for attenuation using the transmission map. So key point to remember, PET scanning is always performed with attenuation correction. And the reason is very simple. If you think about it, the positron emission tomography relies on the principle of two photons hitting the detectors simultaneously, 180 degrees of each other. So nearly simultaneously, there's a coincidence detection window of about 20 nanoseconds. So even if one of the two photons is attenuated, the computer will reject the other count. Therefore, non-attenuation corrected PET images are much more prone to attenuation artifacts than SPECT, than single photon emission tomography. So as a rule, it's important to keep in mind that PET images are always read with attenuation correction. So what are the advantages of attenuation correction? Two things. One is improved image quality. This is an example of a patient who got a SPECT scan without attenuation correction, questionable defect in the lateral wall that may be reversible, and you'll see that the PET scan improves image quality and definitively shows a small reversible defect. The other advantage of attenuation correction is that when you inject a given amount of radio tracer and you measure the radio tracer uptake in the heart, corrected for attenuation, in theory, you have absolute radio tracer quantitation. So you're able to compute how much radio tracer is taken up by the heart. Because of that, attenuation correction greatly helps in myocardial blood flow quantitation because you're able to find out what is truly in the heart.
So the second major advantage is absolute quantitation of myocardial blood flow. That's feasible because of dynamic tomographic imaging, as we discussed earlier, in conjunction with attenuation correction. The one other term which would be useful not for the boards but for clinical reasons is 2D PET and 3D PET. If you think simplistically, 2D PET is PET where the images are acquired with lead septa, very similar to the collimators that we use with SPECT. 3D PET is PET without septa, and you can think of it as something akin to no collimation SPECT. So because of the no collimation, the advantages of 3D is it has much higher sensitivity. It allows us to use much lower radiotracer dose. You can have lower radiation exposure to patient and staff, potential cost savings. What about the challenges? Because there is no electronic collimation, there could be higher scatter fraction. Therefore, the effective sensitivity may be somewhat lower because of random scatter and camera dead time from the high counts. And 3D images typically have much more counts, therefore require more processing time and disk space. So it's much more dependent on computer power. Advantages of cardiac PET and PET CT: images are typically high resolution, high temporal as well as spatial resolution. Depth independent attenuation correction is possible. You can obtain peak stress ejection fraction. You can quantify myocardial blood flow. You can study myocardial metabolism. And with hybrid devices, you're able to study cardiac and coronary anatomy using the CT component. When compared to SPECT, PET has a higher overall diagnostic accuracy. And you can see here, SPECT shown in the pink bars and PET shown in the yellow bars. Sensitivity is not very different, but specificity is much higher for PET compared to non-attenuation corrected SPECT. And the overall accuracy is higher for PET compared to SPECT, mostly driven by higher specificity. When we look at pooled studies and diagnostic accuracy of perfusion PET using various radiotracers like ammonia and rubidium and various stress agents, vasodilator stress agents, you'll find that the overall sensitivity and specificity are very high, sensitivity of 90%, specificity of about 89%. And when you use PET for prognostic assessment, several studies showing that PET works very well for assessing prognosis of patients with known or suspected coronary disease. Patients that have a normal PET have excellent outcomes. Mild, moderate, and severely abnormal PET have much worse outcomes. The same shown in a more recent study from Dr. Beanland's lab. As we pointed out earlier, we are able to compute ejection fraction at peak hyperemia while the patient is on the scanner. The reason for that is, remember, we said rubidium has a 76-second half-life. So you have the patient already on the scanner, you're infusing the vasodilator stress, injecting rubidium and scanning right away. There's no big time delay between hyperemic perfusion and gated study. Because of the peak stress ejection fraction assessment, several groups, including us, have looked at the value of this ejection fraction in predicting multivessel coronary disease, and we see that patients that decrease their ejection fraction from rest to peak stress, this dark here. So patients with left main and multivessel coronary disease tend to decrease their ejection fraction from rest to peak stress, whereas all other groups tend to increase their ejection fraction. And when you look at the prognostic value of this parameter, you find that even after risk adjustment for all other parameters, patients that did not increase EF during peak stress tend to have worse outcomes compared to patients that increase their ejection fraction during peak stress. What is it about quantitative myocardial blood flow? Quantitative myocardial blood flow has been studied nicely to correlate with underlying degree of coronary artery stenosis. These are two separate studies showing coronary artery narrowing on the x-axis and coronary vasodilator reserve on the vertical axis, showing an inverse relationship between blood flow and angiographic epicardial coronary artery stenosis. What about the prognostic value of blood flow quantitation? I'm showing you two separate studies here using N13 ammonia and rubidium, the two more papers which are in press presently, showing that quantitative PET is extremely helpful in risk stratifying patients, patients that have a preserved CFR, normal CFR, have much better outcomes compared to patients that have an abnormal CFR. And the same is shown on the right with rubidium 82. So we've discussed how PET has good diagnostic value, how it's better than SPECT in terms of higher accuracy because of specificity, high sensitivity and specificity for detecting obstructive coronary disease. We also discussed how quantitative myocardial blood flow is inversely related to underlying degree of coronary artery stenosis and how it could help in stratifying risk of patients with known or suspected disease. So what are the indications for cardiac PET? Basically, it's important for you to remember that PET is indicated in patients that are unable to exercise, patients that require adenosine or dipyridamole studies. In whom, a SPECT was found to be equivocal, or as independent study in lieu of SPECT. In patients that are unable to exercise, you can directly consider PET as your first choice. And it's also indicated in patients who are able to exercise but have a left bundle branch block or paced rhythm, which mandates a vasodilator stress in these individuals. So keep in mind, indications for PET, primary indication, patients unable to exercise. And in patients that are able to exercise, you could consider a PET if they have an equivocal SPECT study or if they have an underlying left bundle or paced rhythm. And of course, PET is also indicated for evaluation of heart failure and myocardial viability. So that leads us nicely into the next topic, myocardial viability assessment. We'll briefly discuss a little bit about viability, an overview, then talk about SPECT and then PET. So what is hibernating myocardium? Hibernating myocardium is dysfunctional myocardium that has the potential to improve function following revascularization. Hibernating myocardium is characterized functionally by an improvement in contractile function with reperfusion or inotropic stimulation using dobutamine. Metabolically, hibernating myocardium is characterized by a switch from fat to glucose metabolism, which is accompanied by a reactivation of the fetal gene program. So there's several things that are pointed out here. The first thing is this segment or these segments should have the potential to improve function after revascularization. And we said that this could be also improving function after inotropic stimulation. And that's a nice way for us to study non-invasively these segments. And metabolically, it's important to remember that there's a switch from use of fatty acids to glucose for the metabolic needs. This is very important in understanding FDG PET imaging. There's several algorithms to study patients with heart failure. I've taken one of these algorithms from Dr. Paolo Camici's review from Circulation. So when presented with a patient with signs and symptoms of heart failure and abnormal LV function, what do you do? The first question is, does this patient have underlying coronary artery disease? Yes or no? If they don't have CAD, I think you investigate alternate etiologies, consider dilated cardiomyopathy, valve disease, and other causes. If they do have CAD by your evaluation, then the next question is, does the patient have angina, symptoms of angina? And if the patient does have symptoms of angina, most people will agree that these are ideal candidates for revascularization. Several prior studies have shown that patients with angina and heart failure with multivessel coronary disease tend to do better with revascularization. If they don't have angina or the symptoms are not very clear, then you could consider assessment of ischemia and assessment of viability in that group of patients. And of course, if viability is present or ischemia is present, revascularization could be considered. And if viability is absent, then you could consider other therapies such as resynchronization therapy, ICD, and symptomatic management of heart failure. So the two main steps in this algorithm, the first step of CAD, yes, no, that could be done either by invasive coronary angiography or multi-detector CT angiogram in these days. And the second major diagnostic step is assessing ischemia and viability. And that could be done either using nuclear techniques, echo, or MRI. It totally depends on local expertise. But I just want you to remember that conceptually, these are all the things that you should be considering when you're faced with a patient presenting with symptoms of heart failure and LV dysfunction. Is there coronary disease? Is there angina? Is there ischemia? Is there viability? So all of these questions should be answered. So how do you distinguish between ischemic and non-ischemic cardiomyopathy? If you look at the heart failure guidelines from 05, the old guidelines, they state that only coronary arteriography can reliably demonstrate or exclude the presence of obstructed coronary vessels because perfusion defects and segmental wall motion abnormalities suggestive of CAD are commonly present in patients with a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. So the presence of a perfusion defect or the presence of a regional wall motion abnormality is not specific for coronary artery disease. It could be seen in patients with other etiologies as well. So what you need to definitively diagnose ischemic cardiomyopathy is documentation of obstructive coronary disease on coronary angiography. So for example, take a look at this study here. It's a completely normal stress-rest rubidium 82 imaging. EF is 35% in this patient. With the coronary angiogram, do you predict it's going to be normal, abnormal, or you cannot be sure? So most people would say this would be normal. What about this here? Patient with an abnormal rest rubidium perfusion imaging. This is not stress, it's rest only. And you clearly see multiple perfusion defects in this patient. Patient also has LV dysfunction. How many of you think, please raise your hands, how many of you think coronary angiogram would be normal in this patient? Few hands. How many of you think it would be abnormal? Several more hands. And how many think you cannot be sure? Several more hands. So I agree with the latter two groups. You know, it could be abnormal or you cannot be sure. And this is the coronary angiogram on this patient. Completely normal epicardial coronary arteries. So how do you explain this? Once again, going back to our earlier discussion, perfusion defects and regional wall motion abnormalities are not specific for coronary disease. This is, in fact, the rest perfusion scan of a patient with cardiac sarcoidosis. Patient has LV dysfunction, has clean coronaries, but has cardiac sarcoid, which is resulting in these perfusion defects in a non-coronary pattern. See the basal anterolateral wall and maybe the distal infralateral wall, patchy, not corresponding to a coronary distribution. So once again, the bottom line is the negative predictive value for normal perfusion study is high, close to 100% if you look at the guidelines. However, the positive predictive value of an abnormal perfusion study is only about 50%. Therefore, when you have an abnormal perfusion study, you need to know coronary anatomy before you conclude that this is ischemic cardiomyopathy. So what are the mechanisms of heart failure related to ischemic etiologies? Three main mechanisms. One is ischemia, the other is scar, and the last is endothelial dysfunction. So how do you assess for ischemia and viability? This is an example of a patient. Resting perfusion shown on your left and ejection fraction on the right, 23%. Take a look at the images. What would you do next in this patient? Would you do an F18 FDG study, a thallium redistribution study? Would you do a low-dose dobutamine echo? Or would you do a stress perfusion study? So how many of you vote for FDG PET? Few hands. How many for thallium redistribution? No, this is a PET talk, so that's very good. How many for low-dose dobutamine echo? A few hands. And how many for a stress perfusion study? A few hands. Yeah. So remember again, this is something I teach our fellows all the time. Radionuclide techniques of imaging myocardial perfusion show you cellular uptake of the radiotracer. Presence of perfusion, if the perfusion is normal, if there's radiotracer within the myocytes, those cells are alive. So your viability question is already answered. Your perfusion is decent, it's quite close to normal, telling you that most of the myocytes are viable. So if you look at your questions, options 1, 2, and 3 were looking at viability assessment, and they're all not true because you already know that the patient has myocardium that's all viable. So the most important question in this patient is, does this patient have ischemia that is resulting in stunning post-ischemic LV dysfunction and is causing the LV dysfunction? So this patient went on to have rest dobutamine stress study. Images are shown here, stress rest, alternate rows, rubidium 82 PET, And clearly, you can see the images demonstrating a large severe perfusion defect in the entire LAD distribution, starting all the way at the basal anterior interoceptal walls, going to the mid-anterior interoceptal apical four segments in the true apex, showing significant reversibility along with transient cavity dilation. This is the ejection fraction of the patient, EFO23 at rest, and this is the dobutamine ejection fraction. Once again, this is EF obtained while the dobutamine is infusing. So the EF we expect should have increased significantly in a normal patient with dobutamine. In this patient, the EF didn't increase and in fact went down a little bit. So the teaching point in this case, documentation of stress-induced ischemia is the most potent predictor of improvement of contractile function post-revascularization. In all patients referred for clinical assessment of heart failure, I urge you to look at the resting perfusion. If the perfusion is close to normal or doesn't really show large areas of scar to explain the EF of 20%, as in this case, you must seriously consider stress perfusion imaging as long as there's no contraindication. You know, if that patient had a tight left main stenosis and we saw the perfusion was normal, you didn't need any more testing. You could have gone on to revascularization straight because everything is viable. So these are the things that you should be going through when you're considering patients with heart failure and non-invasive evaluation. So what about metabolic evaluation of myocardial viability? So this is a nice cartoon that I've taken from a review article published in JNM in 2010. And I'll walk you through this. So on the top, you see there is circulation, perfusion, and then in the middle, you have a lot of metabolic steps. And at the far end, you see contractile function. So there's several steps that need to go wrong before you have contractile dysfunction. So your perfusion is the first to go down because of coronary artery disease, we assume, in ischemic cardiomyopathy. Once the perfusion goes down, the metabolic changes within the myocardium. Remember, we spoke about the change from fatty acid to glucose metabolism. So there are changes in metabolism which lead to changes in contractile function. So that is typically the sequence of events. So if you think about assessment, non-invasive assessment of these patients, perfusion is the first step. So perfusion is a very sensitive technique to identify myocardial viability, whereas once you get to the point of contractile dysfunction, then this is a more specific step. So if you can document contractile function or inotropic contractile reserve, then it's a very specific indicator that these cells are still alive. This is something to keep in mind. So what are the ways you can study myocardial viability? You can look at perfusion images. If they are normal, the cells are viable. You can look at various metabolic processes. And if you can identify metabolic activity in areas of hypoperfusion, remember, perfusion has to go down first. So in areas of the myocardium that are hypoperfused, if you can document metabolic activity, those cells by definition are viable because they are metabolically active. And of course, in areas of hypoperfusion and contractile dysfunction, if you can document inotropic contractile reserve, those cells are viable. So how do the various methods compare in terms of diagnostic accuracy? If you look at sensitivity, all the techniques are sensitive to identify viability. Radionuclear techniques are slightly more sensitive than techniques relying on inotropic contractile reserve. By the same token, techniques that rely on inotropic contractile reserve, like dobutamine echo, are more specific compared to radionuclear techniques. So what are the characteristics of dysfunctional but viable myocardium? Once again, this is presenting the same information in a different pattern. So when you're using thallium SPECT, you're relying on measuring perfusion and you're relying on the presence of an intact cell membrane to take up thallium through the sodium potassium ATPase pump. So if you have more than 50% thallium uptake, those cells are viable. What about perfusion with technetium? So this tells us that the cell membrane is intact. It also tells us the mitochondrial function is intact. So there is technetium uptake within the cells. So if you have tracer activity of more than 50%, this redistribution, just note it should be part of the thallium, not in the technetium. Tracer activity of more than 50% in the technetium tells us the cells are viable. What about glucose metabolism? So you could study this using FDG. You can study it using FDG with PET scanners, which is conventionally the way to do it. Or you also have special collimators for SPECT scanners with extra thick sodium iodide crystals that can have stopping power for FDG. And you can do FDG SPECT imaging. That's also possible if you have the right hardware. So if you use FDG, you should see tracer uptake more than 50%. You should see preserved perfusion or FDG uptake. And you should see what we call perfusion metabolism mismatch. What is that? So this is areas of hypoperfusion should demonstrate preserved metabolic activity, preserved FDG uptake. So that's perfusion metabolism mismatch. What about fatty acid metabolism? You can also study fatty acid metabolism. Remember we said myocytes switch from fatty acids to glucose. So if you image glucose, you will see uptake of tracer. If you image fatty acids, viable cells will not be using fatty acids. So you'll image fatty acid defects. So that's the difference between FDG versus fatty acid metabolic studies, where FDG imaging shows uptake of tracer, whereas BMIPP shows defects in areas that are viable. Okay? So there, that'll be the thing to study. What about contractile reserve? You can use dobutamine or dobutamine-gated SPECT with MRI or echo to look at that. And some investigators have combined it with nuclear techniques. I'll show you an example of that. So how could you combine perfusion and contractile reserve? You could do contrast echo at rest and with low-dose dobutamine. You could do the same with nuclear. You could do gated technetium images at rest. Then you infuse low-dose dobutamine and reacquire the gated SPECT again. Okay, that's one way of doing it. So example of case here, 53-year-old mayor with history of prior PCI, admitted with chest pain and a troponin leak, multiple coronary risk factors, got exercise maybe for post-MI evaluation, 70% of the age-predicted maximum heart rate was achieved, non-ischemic clinical response. These are the stress-rest perfusion images. Images clearly demonstrate an inferior wall defect that looks predominantly fixed. And the other point to note here is in a male patient, we don't expect this anterior antroceptal defect. In fact, when you look closely, you get a sense that there may be some reversibility in the distal LAD distribution. This is the patient's polar plots, once again pointing out a distal LAD perfusion defect, inferior perfusion defect. And when you look at the regional radiotracer uptake, stress and rest, you see the uptake is somewhere between 40 to 50% of the peak activity. Gated study in this patient, ejection fraction at rest is 42, and at stress, it's 40%. Sorry, the EF is, the gated movie is not playing here, but anyway, you get the picture, it's a low EF. So in this patient, he had coronary angiography, three vessel disease was diagnosed, and then came back post-CABG. And this is his perfusion, completely normal, EF improved to 60%, confirming hibernation in the inferior wall, and the ischemia in the LAD was also fixed by revascularization. So what's the relationship between resting radiotracer uptake and functional outcome following revascularization? Several investigators have looked at this. If you have radiotracer uptake of more than 40%, then varying proportion of these patients, of these segments in this case, of these segments, will improve function after revascularization. But the important point to note on this figure is that if segments demonstrate very little thallium uptake, less than 40% peak activity, so just so that everyone is clear, so percent peak activity, so what do I mean by that? So when you look at your polar plots, let me go back to that. When you look at your polar plots, this is relative perfusion imaging. The polar plots identifies a given area as maximum within that polar plot. So that's called 100%. So if you compare the defect in relation to that, then that's what is called percent peak activity. Most software programs that you have should be able to provide this information. And the counts, the numbers that you're seeing here on the polar plots are person peak activity. So if you have person peak activity of less than 40, it's unlikely that those segments will recover. But if you have more than 40%, then varying proportions of segments will recover function with revascularization. So how can you better predict that? And that's where viability assessment comes into play. What about technetium, rest technetium uptake, and rest MRI scar imaging? It's very similar results with technetium. If you have less than 40% technetium uptake, here shown in yellow, these segments are highly unlikely to recover function following revascularization, whereas if you have 40 to 60%, half of these recover function. Now, question is which half of these recover function? So that's where you get into the question of redistribution imaging or viability imaging. Interestingly, if you look at the MRI literature in the same fashion, the figure is almost superimposable. Take a look at it. If there is scar of, you know, more than 25 to 40%, these are the percentage of viable segments. Okay, so here, this is scar here, 50 to 75% scar. These segments are highly unlikely to recover function. And then once you get to that magic number of 50% scar, 50% viable, it's the same number that we use for radionuclear techniques as well. Then half of the segments recover function, and we need to figure out how to identify which of those recover function. So teaching point, evaluation of quantitative radiotracer uptake is a useful guide for differentiating viable from non-viable myocardium. It's available, can be easily performed by most practices. I'll quickly go through this slide. This is assessing viability using perfusion and function with gated SPECT. How do you do it? You can do nitrate-enhanced imaging as well as dobutamine-enhanced imaging. So the way to do it is, patient arrives for a test, give 0.4 milligrams of sublingual nitroglycerin or a spray, inject technetium, and obtain rest technetium images. Then, this is your baseline gated rest. Then you infuse dobutamine, and you obtain a second gated rest image. So you can assess contractile function by comparing the first rest to the second rest. Then, of course, you take the patient to the stress lab, perform a stress test, and acquire your stress perfusion images. So using this kind of a protocol, these investigators have shown very nicely that by combined assessment of perfusion and contractile reserve, the overall accuracy of the test is higher. And this may be something to consider if you don't have any other options and if you have the staff to do it. Typically, most practices, in order to give a sublingual nitroglycerin and an infused dobutamine, will need either a nurse or a physician to do that. So if you are equipped to do this, this is something easy, doable, and that could be considered. So teaching point, combined assessment of perfusion and contractile function is feasible with your radionuclear techniques. It provides high accuracy for differentiating viable from non-viable myocardium. A brief word about thallium redistribution imaging. So this is from the era where thallium was used for stress perfusion imaging, followed by delayed images 4 hours later or 24 hours later. So this is a stress perfusion image showing extensive perfusion defects in the LAD as well as in the RCA distribution. Let's assume the normal area has 10 counts and the defect area has 1 count. What happens at 4 hours? There's free redistribution of thallium. So segments that are viable will continue to accumulate thallium, and segments that are non-viable will not take up any more thallium. And the normal segments will be freely redistributing. So the counts in the normal segments tend to go down over time, relatively speaking. So the normal segments will be gradually coming down. The defect segments, since the gradient is still in favor of going into the myocyte, there's still less thallium in the myocyte than in the circulation, they'll be accumulating more and more thallium, and you can then see the redistribution at 4 hours and at 24 hours. So this is basically the stress 4 hour, 24 hour redistribution thallium. How do we do this? Schematically shown here. Do a stress test, inject thallium, wait 10 minutes, do stress perfusion imaging, wait 4 hours, and then you can give this 1 millicurie right before the 4 hour imaging and obtain the 4 hours 10 minutes later. Or you can give it right before the 24-hour imaging and give it and then perform your 24-hour images. So this additional 1 millicurie of thallium is not at the end. It should be in the front here. Sorry, you can make a correction. So you inject the 1 millicurie of thallium and 10 minutes later obtain your 4-hour image, or you inject the 1 millicurie of thallium and obtain a 24-hour image later. Then you can get images which look like this, anterior wall perfusion defect. In this case, there's no redistribution. But if you look at the literature, it suggests that about at least 30% of the regions with fixed defects on stress redistribution imaging will show significant enhancement of thallium uptake after reinjection. And then it looks like the areas of segments that do redistribute are more in the severe range than in the mild to moderate range. And the reason is very simple. We already know that mild to moderate areas are viable, so there's not going to be much more change in those areas, whereas the severe areas are the ones where half of them are viable and half are not, and we can distinguish the two. Now, is there a role for FDG imaging after delayed thallium imaging? So how do you do this? So you can inject, do the same thallium protocol. If you see no redistribution in the 24-hour, you could give FDG and take FDG images. And this is an example of FDG SPECT from our lab several years ago. You can see that the defect was completely fixed, the same case you saw earlier on your 24-hour image. But on the FDG SPECT, there was a nice glucose uptake suggesting that this patient has viable myocardium in the LAD distribution. So FDG PET imaging is slightly more sensitive than thallium imaging or perfusion techniques at assessing viability. So once again, remember, we can study perfusion. We can study metabolic activity or contractile function. We focus so far a lot on perfusion and contractile function, but not much on metabolic imaging, so we'll go into that now. So there are various metabolic pathways within the myocytes that could be imaged using PET. For example, you could study fatty acid metabolic activity, glucose, or you could study overall oxidative flux within the myocyte. And as we discussed, C11 acetate could be used to study oxidative metabolism. And you can use C11 labeled palmitate or SPECT tracers such as BMIPP to study the fatty acid metabolic activity. But the step of beta oxidation, this step in the fatty acid pathway, is exquisitely sensitive to oxygen deprivation. So hypoxic cells, hypoxia, remember, perfusion abnormality is the first step. Hypoxia makes this step difficult. So fatty acid metabolism doesn't happen. So in hypoxic cells, what happens? As a consequence, there's overexpression of these GLUT4 receptors on the myocytes. And as a consequence, there's a switch from fatty acid to glucose metabolic activity. And these cells are much more glucose avid. They take a lot more glucose than normal myocytes. That can be studied using F18 labeled FDG. It follows the pathway of glucose, but once FDG gets converted into FDG6-phosphate, it remains trapped within the myocyte and does not leave the myocyte. So this is what allows us to image FDG within the myocyte. So FDG6-phosphate is what we are imaging in the myocyte. So for clinical purposes, we'll focus mostly on glucose metabolic imaging. So this is a nice table showing myocardial blood flow, myocardial FDG uptake in a glucose-loaded state, and regional function. And in the rows, you see the various categories: normal, hibernating myocardium, transmural scar, non-transmural scar, stunning, and cardiomyopathy. I think the blood flow patterns are very clear to all of you. Normal myocytes have normal blood flow. Hibernating tissue and scar tissue have reduced blood flow. Stunned myocytes have preserved blood flow, and cardiomyopathy of non-ischemic etiology has preserved resting perfusion. So I think the perfusion pattern should be very clear. Normal, non-ischemic cardiomyopathy have preserved blood flow. Hibernation or scar tissue have reduced blood flow. What about glucose uptake in the glucose-loaded state? Of course, normal cells should take up normal uptake. Hibernating cells, perfusion metabolism mismatch, should take a lot more glucose. Increased uptake. Scar tissue should not be metabolically active, so there should be low FDG uptake by scar. Cardiomyopathy should have normal uptake. What about regional function? Normal tissue should be normal, and all others should have decreased function. All right? So the key to remember is you need to understand very clearly in your mind perfusion patterns, contractile function patterns. That's very simple. Perfusion is normal or decreased, contractile function is normal or decreased, and you can use metabolic images to distinguish between the two. How do you do this? You do perfusion, rest and stress perfusion first, then we do what is called glucose manipulation, inject FDG, wait for about 60 minutes, and perform FDG imaging. Why do we need to do glucose manipulation? The way we do glucose manipulation is patient is brought into the test, NPO. We check their blood sugar, give them a glucose load. Typically, it's oral. There are also several IV protocols available that you could use. Then we recheck the blood glucose and administer intravenous insulin. So why do you need to do this? This is an example of a patient, rubidium 82 images showing a nice LAD perfusion defect, but this is the FDG image. Patient is diabetic, did not get a lot of insulin, and you can see if you don't give enough insulin, normal myocytes will not take up glucose. The glucose uptake in normal myocytes is dependent on the availability of circulating insulin. So the goal of this process is to make sure that the normal myocytes take up glucose, so you can compare the glucose uptake in the diseased area to the normal area in your mind to understand whether it's hibernating or not. So patient got more insulin, we reacquired the images, and here you can clearly see the inferior wall that's normal is now your reference segment. And compared to the inferior wall, look at the uptake in the anterior wall. It's as good as the inferior wall. So it's as viable as the inferior wall. So that's how you assess these images. And the reason for performing glucose loading, remember, is to improve uptake in the normal segments, which serve as the reference segment for comparison of the abnormal segments. So four patterns can be seen for flow metabolic activity. Flow, remember, we said is reduced in all areas except for stunned myocardium. What about FDG uptake? In SCAR, there's a matched reduction in glucose metabolism. So perfusion metabolism match is transmural SCAR. Perfusion metabolism mismatch, hibernating tissue. This is non-transmural match. And this last pattern is something we didn't discuss so far. Focus on the infralateral area. The perfusion is normal, but look at the metabolic activity. It's reduced. This pattern is called reverse mismatch. This reverse mismatch pattern is felt to represent stunned myocardium. All right, show of hands here. Case, the mid and apical anterior walls in this case, how many of you think shows transmural SCAR? Show of hands. Several hands. Hibernation. Very good, I can end here. So this is transmural SCAR match pattern. What about this here? The infralateral wall demonstrates. How many think transmural SCAR in the infralateral wall? How many think hibernating myocardium? Several hands. Perfect. Perfusion metabolism mismatch, and that is consistent with hibernating myocardium. What about the septum now? The same images. The septum. What do you think about the septum here? How many think it's transmural SCAR? No hands. How many think it's hibernating myocardium? No hands. How many think it's stunned myocardium? Perfect. This is reverse mismatch. Preserved perfusion, reduced FDG uptake. This is reverse mismatch consistent with stunning. All right, the last few slides now, the home stretch. Looking at data, how they relate outcomes, hibernation, and revascularization. So there are no published prospective randomized clinical studies demonstrating the utility of viability assessment in predicting outcomes. However, there's extensive literature that supports the role of viability with FDG PET in predicting improvement in LV function, heart failure symptoms, and natural history. One study from Dr. DiCarli showing that patients with PET mismatch here tend to do better with bypass than with medical therapy. Without mismatch, they have similar outcomes. What are the other factors that affect outcomes? Baseline left ventricular ejection fraction, magnitude of SCAR, degree of LV remodeling, and time to revascularization. So important to keep in mind that you may have extensive hibernation, but if the ventricle has remodeled already and stretched beyond its limits, it's unlikely that revascularization will bring it back to normal and cause reverse remodeling. So these are some things to keep in mind when you're reading viability assessment. There's one prospective study which was randomized, performed in Canada, 428 patients, EF of less than 35%. Outcomes of cardiac death and MI or hospital stay were studied. So what they did in this study is they looked whether FDG-aided management of LV dysfunction in patients with suspected CAD would alter outcomes compared to standard of care. And the answer to that was no, it does not alter outcomes. But then these investigators went ahead and looked at a subgroup of patients who were adherent to the recommendations and compared to standard of care. So if you look at subgroup of patients that were adherent, what do they mean by that? So if the PET shows viability and suggested that revascularization would help, and the patients got revascularized, those were the adherent group. So if everything went as planned. And the standard group was the group where the physicians were not aware of the results of the viability testing. So at the adherent group, if you look at that, you can clearly see that there seems to be improved outcomes with an FDG PET-guided therapy if you adhere to the recommendation, which is revascularize if hibernating, don't revascularize if no hibernation. The other study that's out in literature that you're all familiar with is viability imaging and outcomes from the STIT study. As you're all familiar, the main study was negative, showing no difference between medical therapy and revascularization. The similar cohort, LVEF less than 35%. And when you look at the viability substudy of the main STIT study, once again, unadjusted outcomes did not show a big difference. But then when you look at the unadjusted, there was a difference. But when you risk adjusted, there was no difference in outcomes based on presence or absence of myocardial viability. So there are several questions about the way viability was defined in the viability sub-study of the STIT study. And we don't have all the answers yet to this. But for now, I think we can suffice it to say that there's no randomized clinical study suggesting that a viability-guided approach improves clinical outcomes in these patients. So to summarize, we've spent the last 1 hour discussing what is PET, how it's performed, talking about the advantages of PET, indications, discussing the various radiotracers. And I hope I have given you a good overview of viability assessment using SPECT and using FDG PET. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much for your attention.